So if you think you're having a bad day, I heard about a man that was working on his motorcycle on his patio, and his wife was in the house in the kitchen, and the man was racing the engine on the motorcycle, and somehow it slipped into gear. And the man, while still holding the handlebars, was dragged through the glass patio door, and the motorcycle just kind of dumped him onto the floor inside the house. And the wife, hearing the crash, ran into the dining room and found her husband lying on the floor and bleeding, and the motorcycle obviously lying next to him, and the patio door shattered. So she ran and called the ambulance, summoned the ambulance. But they lived on this kind of fairly large hill, and the wife had to go down several flights of long steps to the street to direct the paramedics to her husband. And so the paramedics arrived, transported the husband to the hospital. The wife uprighted the motorcycle and pushed it outside, and then realized that there was gas spilled all over the floor. So she got some towels and paper towels and blotted up the gas with the towels, and then the paper towel she took and threw into the toilet. The husband was treated in the hospital, released to come home, and when he got home, he realized he had a shattered patio door, damage was done to his motorcycle, so he got despondent and went into the bathroom, sat down on the toilet, lit up a cigarette, and after finishing the cigarette, he just naturally flipped it between his legs into the toilet while still seated, and the wife heard a loud explosion and her husband screaming. So she ran into the bathroom, found her husband laying on the floor. His pants had been blown away. He was suffering from burns on the buttocks and other places. And the wife again ran to the phone, called for the ambulance. The ambulance crew was dispatched. The wife met them on the street. The paramedics loaded up the husband on the stretcher and began carrying him again down these flights of stairs to the street. And while they were going down the stairs to the street, accompanied by the wife, one of the paramedics asked the wife, "How did the husband burn himself?" And she told them the entire story. And the paramedic started laughing so hard that he tipped the stretcher and dumped the husband out, and he fell down the remaining steps and broke his arm. So you think you've had a bad day. 3 years ago, we traveled to Cabo San Lucas, which is in Mexico, for a family vacation. And we had been out of the country before, not with all of the children and not by anything other than boat. We had never flown out of the country as an entire family. I had assumed by mistake, which is so unlike me in every way, I had assumed by mistake that when you leave the country with small children, I think Zach and Reagan at that time were, 12 and around that age, and when you leave the country by anything other than boat, every person, no matter what age, has to have a passport. So we got to the airport to leave at the Huntsville Airport. This is a time when I was traveling like crazy, so they like knew me there. And we gave the passports we had, and then we had birth certificates we thought was sufficient for the younger two. And they said to me, to leave the country, everyone has to have a passport. Like, well, I've been out of the country. The kids have been out of the country. How did you go out of the country? By boat? Then that's a whole different story. But I was still persuaded that I could somehow talk them into letting us all on the plane. So I said, look, just get me to Atlanta. We have the layover in Atlanta. It's the home of Delta, busiest airport in the world. All my flights were with Delta. I had high status with Delta at that time. I had confidence in Delta that they could get us where we wanted to go. And she was like, well, I can fly you to Atlanta, but you're going to be stuck there. And I was like, no, I can talk anybody into anything kind of attitude. And so they got me to Atlanta, and through the midst of all this turmoil back and forth with customer service and managers and all this, they finally looked at me in the eye and said, you are not leaving the country, all five of you, to go to Cabo San Lucas. This is on a Saturday, like the only possible means that you're going to have to go is on Monday morning. The passport office in Atlanta will open, and if you are there, they take a certain amount of people that do not have an appointment, and you can get a one-day passport. in Atlanta. And so we had to drive back here, rent a car, drive back here, get all the paperwork they needed to be able to get that one-day passport, get to the passport office at 5 a.m. and stand in this line initially inside. And they came out and said, hey, you guys can't stand inside. You have to stand outside and wait for the building to open and then the office to open. And so it became a long ordeal of standing in multiple in line for multiple hours with multiple other people who all had stories equally as heartbreaking as ours. There were people in that line that couldn't leave the country because they had a dime-sized smudge on their passport. One family beside us missed an entire 10-day European vacation because there was a spot on one of their passports. Are you kidding me? And so a lot of people having a really, really bad day that seemed to only get worse and worse and worse and worse. The good news for us is we were on the last ones that they let in, and we got our one-day passports before Zach and Reagan were able to fly out that evening and enjoy the rest of our vacation. But it seemed like everything was happening and our day just kept getting worse. Have you ever had one of those days? The only bright spot in the middle of all that, I was in a, let me say this kindly, heated conversation with one of the Delta agents, and Zach comes running up beside me and tugs on my shirt. I was like, what? Dad, I just saw Daryl in the airport. Daryl is Norman Reedus, plays Daryl on The Walking Dead, which is filmed in Atlanta. And I was like, go catch him and say hi. I don't know what to say. Leave me alone in this moment. I don't care if you saw the president. We're trying to get to Mexico. And so that was the bright spot. We saw Daryl in the Atlanta airport in that moment, and Zach didn't go tell him hi. But anyway, so you ever had one of those days where things just get worse? How about a season of life where things just seem to get worse and worse and worse? We left our primary character of this story, our primary human character, the real character of all of this story is God. But we left our primary human character in a tough season of life when we were in 1 Kings last week. If you have a Bible, go to 1 Kings. That's where we are. 1 Kings chapter 17 today. Elijah was in a tough season. He had been sent into isolation by God. He was living alone by a brook, with no one there, no one there to comfort him, no companionship, no relationship. He was left alone. The good news is God was feeding him by birds. God commanded the ravens every morning and every evening to bring Elijah bread and meat. We emphasized that last week. He didn't bring him broccoli and cauliflower. He brought him meat. He was being fed by the birds. There's no spiritual application to that. He was being fed by the birds, and he was given water from the brook until God answered his prayer. It seems like that's always good news. God heard and answered my prayer. The only problem was the prayer that Elijah had prayed is that a drought would come over the entire region, and that's exactly what happened. God heard and answered his prayer, and his brook dried up. God heard his prayer, and his resource ran out. His supply ran out. His brook dried up. Let me back up briefly in the story. Elijah, the country boy prophet, had been chosen and sent by God to stand in front of the most evil and powerful couple, maybe in all of the Bible, Ahab and Jezebel. And he had stood before this powerful couple with an announcement: there is one God, and the God is not Baal. I know you serve Baal, Ahab, and Jezebel, but there is only one true God, one living God, and that God is not the God that you serve. It is Yahweh. It is the one true God, and this God is calling us back to repentance. That time, Israel was living in some very dark and idolatrous days, and Elijah pronounces, "You have turned from God." These are dark days, and God's judgment will be poured out upon the country. There will be no rain, no dew for years to come. Now, the false god Baal was known for being the god of rain and dew. As a matter of fact, if you read mythology, Baal was a god whose daughters were rain and dew. And Elijah says, I'll show you who controls the weather. It's not Baal. It is God. And there will be no rain or no dew until God says so. The land and the people will suffer as a result of sin. And so this great showdown is about to take place. But instead of the showdown, God sends Elijah into isolation. He sends him into isolation to protect him, to keep him safe, but more importantly, as we emphasized last week, to prepare him. It was a season of protection and preparation. And we said it is very common for God to send his followers through difficult seasons in order to prepare us for his work, both in us and through us. We see that throughout the biblical narrative. Time and time again, God's sending his followers through difficult seasons, not for the sake of sending them through difficult seasons, but for the sake of protecting them many times from themselves, but preparing them for greater things that lied ahead of them. Elijah is learning a lesson. He's not learning, and this is very important to understand, he's not learning a lesson about survival. Elijah's not learning a lesson about how strong he is. Sometimes we kind of miss that. We think that God is sending Elijah into isolation so Elijah will realize how strong he is, that he can survive. And if you're in a season of difficulty, if you have that mentality about the season of difficulty, then you're going to kind of miss God's purpose. God doesn't send us through these seasons just to say, hey, look how strong I am. Look what I can go through. Look what I can endure. It wasn't a lesson about survival. It was a lesson about sovereignty, right? It was a lesson about dependence upon God. It was not about how strong Elijah is. It was about how strong God is, how big God is. If the lesson is about survival, then that's about my strength. But if the lesson's about dependence and faith and trust, then that's a lesson about God's strength, God's provision. And that's what Elijah was going through. See, here's the reality of trials. You are in one of three places when it comes to trials today. You are either in a trial, and some of you are right in the middle of one. You are either coming out of a trial. You've gone through a difficult season that it seems to be letting up and things are looking good. Or you are in a season where you're about to go into a trial. You're in one of those three places today. You're either in one, coming out of one, or you're going to be facing one in the near future. That's the reality of the broken world in which we live. And it's in seasons of trial that God teaches us about faith. He teaches us about dependence. He teaches us about trust. Now, if we keep those three things in mind, in one, coming out of one, about to face one. If you were to ask Elijah when his brook dried up and God called him to go somewhere else, Elijah probably thought he was coming out of a season of trial. But we will see that God had even deeper plans for him. Let's pick up the story in chapter 17, verse 8. We left off in 17:7 last week where the brook had dried up. 17:8, then the word of the Lord came to him. So Elijah's thankful to hear from God because his brook has dried up. Verse 9, arise, go to Zarephath, which belongs to Sidon, and dwell there. Behold, I have commanded. So we hear another command from God. Last week the ravens were commanded. This time, behold, I have commanded a widow there to feed you. So let me put this in perspective for you. God sends Elijah to the land of Zarephath, which is in Sidon. Now, Sidon, if you remember what I told you in week one about Ahab and Jezebel, Jezebel was not from Israel. She was a non-Jew. She was from a neighboring country. The Phoenicians is where Jezebel was from. She was a Phoenician princess. She was the daughter of a Phoenician king. And that region of Phoenicia, there was a city called Sidon. God sends Elijah into the heart of Jezebel's territory. Now, doesn't that say something about God? I mean, this is really a royal rumble between God, Jehovah God, and Baal. And God sends Elijah into the heart of Jezebel's territory. God again is saying, I will show you who the one true God is. Elijah, I want you to go into the very heart of Jezebel's territory. I have a plan there for you. This was about 100 miles away from the brook of Cherith where he had been, 100 miles through unprotected territory. So again, Elijah's life is kind of on the line. They're hunting down prophets to kill them. Now, they're trying to replace all of the prophets of Jehovah with the prophets of Baal. And so a manhunt has been issued for guys like Elijah. And by the way, he can't pick up his iPhone and call Uber to get him there safely. There's no cabs. There's no way for him to go except to walk through unprotected territory into this distant land. Now, when we looked at Cherith last week, I told you that the word Cherith means to cut down or to cut off. It symbolized what Elijah was going through. Interesting that this week God sends Elijah into the land of Zarephath. This is the Hebrew word. The verb means to melt something or to smelt something, which has to do with heat. If you translate it as a noun, it means the crucible. Now, we recognize that term, right, to do with crucifixion. So even the name of the territory has to do with what God is teaching Elijah. How many of you have had some type of machine shop experience where you had to use heat for some purpose, either welding or melting the impurities of something? Okay, so a lot of you went through machine shop experience somehow. And so you kind of understand the idea of heat treating, right? Treating something with heat. Back in the kind of old school days, before there were modern metal working techniques such as welding and things like that, the old school blacksmiths would use heat to make metal workable. If you like to watch shows like Vikings or shows that are kind of from a different era, when they're making swords and things like that, right, they would heat up the metal and they would get rid of the impurities and they would make it hot so that they could make it workable, so that they could refine it, so they could shape it. And when you're watching shows like that and you got some, you know, rugged blacksmith that's beating on an anvil with a hammer and shaping a sword, after it gets really hot and after he shapes it the way he wants it, what does he immediately do with it? Puts it into cold water, right? Kind of that heat and then cool, because the cooling effect makes the metal hard. It makes it no longer workable, but it seals the work that's been done. And so the concept is that heat melts things away. It melts away the impurities. The word that's often used is that word slag. If you see like gold that's being refined or something, there's kind of a layer of stuff that has to be skimmed off. The impurities have to be skimmed off. And so it melts away the slag and then is quickly cooled to make the metal strong. It refines the metal. It purifies the metal. And so God sends Elijah into Zarephath. The name means to smelt, to melt something, to purify. And he sends him there to continue this refining process. Now, I think it's interesting, God's instructions to Elijah. It's kind of a threefold if you see the verses. He says to him, first, arise, like get up, make yourself available. Like, I know your brook is dried up, but now it's time to get up. You know, something that I've discovered is kind of going through ministry and dealing with a lot of people in a lot of different life situations, and even my own life, it's very easy to get comfortable with the uncomfortable. Meaning, if God has you going through a difficult season, it's easy to let that define you, to get comfortable with that. This has a lot of different labels in modern culture. You'll kind of hear it falling into victimhood, or you choose to be the victim instead of trying to rise above that. A lot of different ways that we break it down. But for us spiritually, it's easy for us to simply get comfortable in a status of being uncomfortable. Because when you're in that uncomfortable status, you kind of always have an excuse, don't you? It's someone else's fault, or I went through this in life, or this happened to me, or whatever. It's easy to get, sometimes the most difficult faith step when God is calling us into a different season, whether that's an easier or difficult one, when God's calling us is to get up, to get out of our status of being uncomfortable. So God says to Elijah, like, make yourself available, get up. Sometimes that most difficult step is just getting going, because you don't feel like it. how this often translates in the church life. There's so many people out there today who have been burned by the church for whatever reason. They have felt like they've been mistreated, and maybe the church has mistreated them in some way, but a lot of people that get burned by the church, and so their kind of natural reaction to that is just to bail on the church, right? Like, I don't want to have anything to do with it. And it's easy to get comfortable with that status because you've been burned by something. So it's just easier to not be a part of it. And just because we are a church, we're kind of talking about in church terms. It's not just connected to just the church, but you understand what I'm saying. A lot of people out there, they just don't go to church. I meet a lot of people that claim to be spiritual people, but they don't have anything to do with the church. They have reached a place where they're just uncomfortable, or they're comfortable being uncomfortable with the church. And sometimes that most difficult step is the arise step. I don't feel like it. I've been burned by it. I'm hardened toward it. I'm burned by it. And sometimes that first faith step is the most trying step. Arise, like get up. And then God told him to go, like get up out of this status of the brook is dried up. Get up and go. Take a step. Step of obedience. Step of faith. Get up and get going. Live out your faith. Take one step at a time. Going is always about one step in front of the other, one at a time. God is not going to teleport him 100 miles away. He's not going to send a chariot, which is an ironic statement in light of the end of Elijah's life when God does send a chariot. But in this instance, God is not saying to him, hey, I'm going to take care. I'm going to get you from point A to point B. He says to him, get up and go. Take a step at a time. And I would encourage you, if you're in that season of life, in a difficult season of life, and you're unsure what God is doing, and you feel like your brook is dried up, the natural steps are to get up and do something. Get up and take a faith step. Take one step at a time. Get up and go. That's a step of obedience. And then notice that he says, arise, go. And when you get there, I want you to stay there. This is a step of commitment. It's a step of patience. It's a step of waiting on God. So God says, get up, take steps. And when you enter this season, when you enter this next phase, I want you to wait on me there. I want you to stay there. We saw that when God sent him to the brook Cherith, right? He said, I want you to go and live there. He says, here, I want you to go and dwell there. I want you to wait on me. That's my most difficult step, is waiting on God. Because I want things to happen quickly and on my timeline and my schedule. And if I can fit him in at 10 a.m. or 6 p.m., if I can set an appointment to make things happen. But the most difficult step is to wait on God, to realize that he is in control and that my calling is to get up, take steps, and then wait on God to make things happen, to be faithful in what God's called me to do. So this is very important. Arise, go, stay there. Here's what I want you to know about what God was doing. God knows where Elijah is. He didn't put him at the brook and forget about him. God had not forgotten about Elijah. It may have seemed like he had when the brook dried up. It may have seemed like God had forgotten him there. But God had not forgotten him. But not only did God know where Elijah was or is, God knew where Elijah was going. He knew the next season. He knew the next step. And I'm not just talking about Zarephath here, not just going to where the widow was. I'm talking about that God had a big platform upon which Elijah was going to stand, where he was going to have that showdown with 800 prophets and a king and queen that wanted him dead. Elijah was going to come face to face with them in a all-in moment where either God was legit or he was not legit, and everything was going to hinge on that moment. And God knew where Elijah was headed. Elijah didn't know he was going to be standing on Mount Carmel. But God knew it. God knew where Elijah was. He knew where Elijah was going. And he knew the steps Elijah needed to take to get him ready for Mount Carmel. Let me encourage you today. God has not forgotten you. It may feel like it at times. You may feel like if you're stuck in a dead-end job or stuck in an unhappy marriage, you're stuck in a struggling relationship, or God's provision doesn't seem to be there, or you seem like your bank account's getting lower and is dwindling faster than stuff is coming into it. It may seem like that God has forgotten you where you're at, but I want to encourage you that God has not forgotten you where you are. Even when your brook dries up, God hasn't forgotten you. He knows exactly where you are, and God knows where He wants to take you. He knows your next step. He knows where you are, and He knows where He is taking you. Now listen, where He is taking you might not be what you are expecting. It might not be what you are wanting, but He knows where you're going. It may not be your plan, but He knows where He's taking you. It may not be your ideal, but He knows where He's taking you. He knows where you are. He knows what seasons you're going through. He knows what seasons that He needs to take you through in order to get you where He wants you. Whether that's where you want to be or expecting to be or not, God's taking you somewhere and He can be trusted. So our challenge is, will I trust God during these seasons of my life? Will I trust God with where I am right now? And will I trust God with where He's taking me? It's a trust issue. God is always the provider, isn't He? Behold, He says, I have commanded a widow to feed you. This is the same God that last week we saw commands birds. He commanded unclean birds to bring Elijah food and provide for him. And now God says, I'm going to provide a widow. I'm commanding a widow to take care of you. Now, let me tell you what that means in that context. One, in that culture, it was a big deal. One, that she was a woman that was going to be providing for him. Two, she was a Gentile, non-Jew. Three, she was destitute, poor. Four, she was a widow. Men were not supposed to have anything to do with poor widows. In that culture, that was male dominant, right? Right or wrong, it's the way the culture was at that time. And so Elijah was saying to her, or God was saying to Elijah, I'm sending you to depend upon this woman. Last week it was an unclean bird. This week it is, spiritually speaking, in that world, an unclean woman. She was not a Jew. She was a Gentile. She was not a follower of God. And God says, this widow is going to provide for you. The widow's providing for the prophet. Initially, things are going to turn, but God's teaching Elijah a much deeper lesson on dependence. Not just depending on God, but a lesson that involved humility. Here was Elijah's challenge. Am I going to trust someone who, from all indications, is not trustworthy? Will I trust God, who is asking me to depend on someone who's not trustworthy? There's nothing about the world in which Elijah lived that said, trust this woman. Everything said the opposite. She was the wrong gender in his world. She was the wrong religion. She was on the wrong end of the social scale. Everything was the opposite. And God says, will you trust me by trusting her? Now, this widow, she was in a very precarious situation, wasn't she? She was dependent on the charity of other people. Again, in that culture, she depended on other people to provide for her. And now the entire region has been taken over by this drought. And so God is asking Elijah to depend upon a person, a widow, who herself is dependent upon others. Are you following God's math here? Elijah, I need you to depend upon someone who is dependent on other people. God's economy often doesn't make rational, logical sense in our minds. I don't know what that conversation looked like, but God was calling Elijah to a level of faith because God is constantly at work behind the scenes to accomplish His purposes. The prophet Isaiah said, His ways are always bigger than our ways. His thoughts are bigger than our thoughts. They don't always make sense to us. Are you like me? I like to put God in my logical box. I like to try to squeeze this infinite God into something that makes sense. At my little tiny pinpoint moment in world history, I like to squeeze this infinite God who is above time and beyond time and sees the entire picture from beginning to end. And yet I like to try to put God right in my pinpoint moment of history and say, God, I need to understand you. And God says, my ways are bigger than your ways. My thoughts are bigger than your mind can even think. I am working something that's much bigger than you'll ever comprehend. Maybe not even in my lifetime will I see it, but I am at work accomplishing my purposes through my creation. Elijah, I need you to depend upon someone who is dependent upon other people. Pick up verse 10. So he, again Elijah, I love his life rhythm here. So he arose and went to Zarephath. Elijah's obedience is on display again. He got up and he went. Get up and go, God says. And Elijah gets up and goes. Very common for Elijah. So he gets up and he goes. And when he came to the gate of the city, behold, a widow was there gathering sticks. And he called to her and said, bring me a little water in a vessel that I may drink. And as she was going to bring it, he called to her and said, bring me a morsel of bread in your hand. So Elijah arrives, and there he finds the woman looking for sticks, which is an indicator of her social status, life status. And let me just say here, God's provision does not always look like what we anticipate that it's going to look like or what we think it should look like. So here's a widow gathering sticks. That's God's provision for her. And then the story gets worse. Elijah says to her, look, I need a cup of water. I need bread. And then look at verse 12. And she says to him, as the Lord your God, okay, so there's an identifier, as the Lord your God lives, not my God, not her God, as the Lord your God lives, I have nothing baked, only a handful of flour in a jar and a little oil in a jug. And now I'm gathering a couple of sticks, listen to this, that I may go in and prepare it for myself and my son, that we may eat it and die. Things get worse. She is gathering sticks to make a final meal before her death and the death of her child. They are literally on the verge of starving to death. So picture Elijah. Here's this widow, this destitute woman, preparing her last meal for her and her son. And Elijah says, hey, before you go and prepare your last meal to die, Can I get a cup of water? Like, can I get a morsel of bread? Before you make your final meal in preparation to die, I have a favor to ask. Can I have your bread? Verse 13. A shift occurs in the text. And Elijah said to her, do not fear. Go and do as you have said, but first make me a little cake of it and bring it to me, and afterward make something for yourself and son. Hey, but before you make your final meal, I need you to make me a loaf of bread. 4:14, thus says the Lord, the God of Israel. So again, he identifies, this is the God of Israel. The jar of flour shall not be spent. The jug of oil shall not be empty until the day that the Lord sends rain upon the earth. And so she went and did as Elijah said. And she and he and her household ate for many days. The jug of flour was not spent, neither did the jug of oil become empty, according to the word of the Lord that he spoke by Elijah. So this shift occurs in the text from Elijah's needs to the woman in need. Listen to this. Elijah's test. Elijah's trial becomes his means of ministry. It becomes the way that he ministers to someone else. Our trials, our tests, they become a part of our story, don't they? Our trials and our tests become a part of our journey. They become a part of our story with the divine intention of becoming a means to minister to other people. Like, my story, my journey, is a means to minister to others. Did you know, because of the journey that God has taken me on through the good, the bad, the ugly, the brutal, the sin, the repentance, the redemption, restoration, healing, because of the journey that God has taken me on, has taken us on, has taken Ashley and I on, the kids on, because of our journey, because of our story, because of our trials and our tests, even when they're self-imposed, because of my story, I understand and relate to struggles that I did not identify with before. I understand and relate to brokenness like I never have. I understand and relate to people caught up in sin like I never have. I understand grace like I never have. I'm faster to forgive than I ever have been. I'm quicker to give grace than I ever have been. You know why? Because my story involved those things. And because I have experienced certain things, my story and my journey allows me to minister to people in a different way because of the trials that God has taken me through. And I love the fact that our call to ministry, as reflected here in the life of Elijah, is often to the insignificant and the unnoticed and the neglected and the hurt and those who have been abused in society. James, the brother of Jesus, would say, you want to know what pure religion is? It's ministry to widows and orphans, the neglected, the abused of culture. Man, we get so fascinated with celebrity Christianity, don't we? I mean, we do our best to try to turn celebrities into, they make some statement about God and we plaster them all over social media like, did you hear what Chris Pratt said? Like, he is the most religious person on the planet. Like, we are so quick to try to find Christian celebrities and turn those people into followers of Christ that we can look to. But when we read the pages of the story, the redemptive story of the Bible, is often not the celebrity Christian where the story of grace is found. The story of redemption is most often found in back alleys and brothels and off the beaten path. It's most often found in the story of a widow gathering sticks. God's story is often moving among the neglected, the abused, the hurting. God knew where Elijah was, but God also knew where she, the widow, is. She was a destitute widow in need of provision. And here was a woman outside of God's people, a Gentile, outside of the social norm, a destitute woman. But God knew exactly where she was. Remember when we went through John 4 and Jesus talks to the woman at the well? And God knew exactly where she was in Samaria, and he sent, and Jesus went through Samaria on purpose because he knew exactly where she was, and that person needed the story of grace. God knew exactly where this destitute widow is, and he sends Elijah right to her. In the cloak of Elijah needs ministry done to him, but in the process, the tables are turned. This destitute widow is in need of provision. And so God's test of faith for her is provide for Elijah first. Trust me with everything important to you. Trust me with what you have left. Elijah asked her for a morsel. You ever been in a place in life where a morsel is all you have? Elijah says, I want you to provide your morsel. This is a life-death scenario for her. God is asking her to give up what she has to preserve the life of not only her, but her son. That's all she has left. And God says to her, trust me with your life and the life of your son. Feed a stranger. I already told you, prophets are kind of these wild-eyed, crazy people. And here Elijah shows up after walking 100 miles through the desert. I mean, come on. Speed stick cannot accomplish that trick. And here he shows up and says, give me everything. Can God be trusted with that which is the closest to me, that my most valuable possessions in life? Can God be trusted? Can he be trusted with the life of my children? Can he be trusted with my financial means? Can he be trusted with those things that I hold the closest to my heart? Can God be trusted with that? And her instructions are very simple. Go and do. And the text says she went and did. Man, and God provided. Obedience seems so simple in this context. Go and do, and God will provide. We love to complicate it with our unknown. We love to complicate it with the complicated. We love to complicate it with the what ifs of life. We love to complicate obedience. But we are reminded again, as we were the previous weeks, God provides for us as we take steps of obedience. When the path is not always clear, when I don't know the resource, when I don't know the means, when I don't know how God's going to provide, then God asks me to take steps of obedience, and he provides as I obey. It's not always that way, is it? But most often, it is as we take steps of obedience that God provides. I'm not sure I wrap my mind around this, but this widow experienced the provision of a God that she didn't even worship. It's your God, she says. And God provided her and Elijah. And just like he did for Elijah, he provided her as she needed it. It wasn't like, hey, go look behind your house. There's like enough bread back there to do for the rest of the famine. Hey, you see the 50-gallon drum in the corner? It's full of oil. It was daily as she needed it. When she went back to the jar for oil, it was there. When she went back to the bin for food, it was there. It was daily as she needed it. Doesn't that make sense in light of Jesus' prayer when his disciples said, God, how should we pray? And he said, you pray, our Father which art in heaven, give us this day our what? Daily bread. It is daily dependence upon God. So here's the key question, the key understanding to this entire passage and message for today. Will I put my continued trust in the provider or the provision? Will I put my constant, continual trust in the provider, in God, or will I put my continued trust in what he provides, in the gifts, in the provision? We tend to trust the provision. We tend to trust the tangible because we can touch it and we can count it. And we can plan for it, and we can plan with it, and we can save it or not save it. We tend to trust the provision, but God invites us to trust him. God invites us to trust the provider, a God that we can't see, a God we can't analyze, a God we can't forecast, but a God who is a provider, and he is a good provider. And he is an able provider, and he is a willing provider, and he is a sovereign provider, and he is a trustworthy provider, a God who is a good provider. And his invitation is, will you trust me, not my provision, not the gift, not the bread, not the endless oil? That's just a tool to put your eyes on me. Will you trust me? Will you trust me when the bread runs out? Will you trust me when the oil is empty? Will you trust me when the life of your son is on the line? Will you trust the provider, not the provision? Will you trust the provider, the God who provides? Listen, the God who provides for both his prophet, the man of God, and he provides for the Gentile, destitute, starving widow. The God who provides. Next week, what happens when God acts in a way contrary to my desires? Can God be trusted when it seems like everything is against me? You see, this is not the end of the story. The happily ever after here says, and the widow and her son lived happily ever after with endless bread and endless oil. Well, that's not how the story goes. If you want to read ahead. You'll get a glimpse of what happens when God takes us from the brook Cherith to the town of Zarephath, to the valley of death itself. Can God be trusted? Here's our gospel reminder at the end. God, our provider, provided the ultimate provision in Jesus Christ. Jesus, who faced the ultimate test. Jesus, who faced the fiercest fire. Jesus, who endured the shame and humiliation of the cross. Jesus, who became sin for us so that we might become the righteousness of God. Jesus, who endured the humiliation and the shame and the fire and the test and the trial, and he did it without sinning, without blemish, without error, without a lack of faith. Jesus, who went through and faced the trials that I do not have to face so that he might be my source of faith and confidence. Jesus, who endured death so that I might have life. Jesus, who endured the cross so that I might live life knowing God is in control. That whatever I'm going through, whatever test, whatever trial, that God is using it to refine me, to purify me, to mature me, so that I might learn to trust him deeper as he rewrites my story. And so that my story in return becomes a part of someone else's story. So that my trial becomes a means of ministry to other people. And as the story continues, listen, following Jesus does not mean that we bypass Cherith. Following Jesus does not mean that we sidestep Zarephath. The opposite is true. Following Jesus guarantees the brook Cherith. Following Jesus guarantees the city Zarephath, where you see the widow gathering sticks. Following Jesus guarantees that God is not absent at Cherith. God is not punishing you at Zarephath. That's the gospel for us. The gospel is not you get out of the difficult times. The gospel is not, hey, once you take this step of faith, everything's going to be pleasant and happy and your bank account's going to be full and your health is going to be everything you want it to be and things are never going to go against you. And that's not the gospel. The gospel is you're going to live life and there's going to be seasons that you're sitting by the brook and it dries up. There's going to be times God calls you to take steps of faith that are uncomfortable to you. And it may take you into a season of more difficulty than you ever anticipated. But the gospel says, God is with you. God is with you. He is not punishing you. Jesus took your punishment on the cross. God has promised, I will never leave you. I will never forsake you. He is present. He is near. He is in control. He knows where you are right now. He hasn't forgotten you. He knows where you are. And he knows where you're going. He knows where he is taking you, and he can be trusted. Whatever you're facing, he can be trusted. Brook dried up, he can be trusted. I need you to go here, and you're going to have to depend on someone who's not trustworthy. God can be trusted. I need you to forgive when it doesn't make sense to forgive. God can be trusted. I need you to exercise grace when it doesn't. I know what they said about you. I know what they said to you. I know what they've been saying behind your back. God can't be trusted. I know they hurt you. I know they disappointed you. I know your relationship has been broken and shattered. You're sitting by the brook and it feels like it's dried up. God can be trusted. God, I don't want to, but God can be trusted. I don't want to forgive, but God can be trusted. I don't want to display grace, but God can be trusted. I don't want to love that person, but God can be trusted. And he invites you. Will you trust the provider? Are you going to put your faith in the provision that may come and may go? God can be trusted even when we face the ultimate test, death itself.